And let me call to the podium. I have the distinct pleasure of presenting to you our next panel. And I would like to have the three speakers please come forward, and I will briefly introduce them to you. Barbara Barzanski. And Barbara, I should have made sure I was saying your name correctly. Mary Jane, there she comes here. And another Heidi, which I don't often be at a meeting where there's another Heidi. And we both said the same thing. So this time we're going to get their slides up because this Heidi has ran way over. And see, I didn't do any insults, Barbara. And let's get your presentations up here. And I think Barbara started first. Okay? And all of their three bios are in your notebook, so I won't take any more time to read those to you.
Okay.
Now, what, no, put it on there for you. And use this down arrow.
Okay.
Thanks so much. I'd like to pick up on some of the ideas that have been talked about already in the context of the Liaison Committee on Medical Education, which is the accrediting body for MD programs. And I want to talk about the issue of monitoring. And that's going to be kind of a framework for some of the issues that will pick up on what's been talked about already. So the utility of regular program monitoring, not just in the regular accreditation cycle, but the ability to do monitoring on a regular basis, especially around particular standards that you'd want to keep track of relatively quickly and reasonably. So talk about how the LCME uses annual monitoring and standardized instruments to talk about compliance with particular kinds of standards. And I'm going to use some examples of standards related to professionalism and clinical skills and knowledge standards. But we use this as kind of a general concept. And also how you use monitoring to determine when you're really ready for new standards. And in this case, we talk about interprofessional education because it's something that the LCME has been thinking about and probably will adopt a standard within the next year or so. So the LCME itself, it accredits medical education programs leading to the MD degree in the U.S. and also in Canada in collaboration with a Canadian accrediting body. It has 19 members. It's got professional members who are physicians, educators and practitioners, medical students and members of the public. And it has sponsors who are the American Medical Association, theoretically representing the medical profession, and the Association of American Medical Colleges, who represent the colleges and the educational programs. And both of those groups appoint the professional members and the student members. And as of today, we have 138 LCME accredited programs. In a couple of weeks, ask me again, because it'll be more. The LCME right now has 131 standards, which makes it somewhat unique among accrediting bodies who have fewer. And we're working on clustering standards, but they divide into five sections. One is the institutional setting, which talks about administration and governance of medical schools and about the academic environment in which students learn. The educational program, medical students, involves student services, admissions, things around the student cluster, faculty, and the educational program resources, which are things that keep the institution running. For example, finances, educational space, clinical resources. Each of these sections of our standards are reviewed on a five-year basis so that this year we're working on the educational program, and questionnaires have gone out to between 1,000 and 2,000 stakeholders from the different stakeholder groups who might have interests in these standards. And they're asked to evaluate the standards for their clarity and for their importance. And they are also allowed to make comments about the standards. And so the ability to get this kind of 360-degree assessment of our standards allows for changes to be ongoing. And those changes, additions to standards, deletions of standards, which happens very rarely but does happen, and substantive changes to the standards themselves require input before they can be finalized. So we require a public hearing, and we require input from the LCME sponsors. So there's always churning of standards. There's always review, and there's always change. I'm just going to share with you some examples of types of monitoring tools that we use. When medical schools go through their regular 8-year review, they fill out a questionnaire, which ends up being about this thick when it's done, and it has questions related to each accreditation standard. But we also have tools, most of which are developed by the sponsoring organizations with LCME input, that are sent to medical schools or subgroups of medical schools on an annual basis. And these are disseminated under the auspices of the sponsors, but they have questions that are linked to specific standards. I think there was an example of your graduation questionnaire for pharmacy students. We have the same thing for medical students, and a lot of those questions feed directly into the accreditation standards. So these results of these questionnaires are used for annual monitoring and also during full survey reviews because they allow trend data. They allow you to look over 8 years of a particular set of data, enable to allow you to see whether there have been significant changes at an institution, and if there are changes that are not in the direction you'd like them to be, the ability to ask why and to collect more specific data. A lot of these questionnaires also allow cross-sectional national data, so you can set up norms both at the regular review process and at the annual review process. And in addition to questionnaires, there are other standardized instruments that allow benchmarking of school performance. These are national standardized tests. For example, our licensing exam has parts that deal with knowledge, but there's also a part of the licensing exam that's a clinical skills exam. So you can look at how individual programs compare over compared to their peer institutions. And there's also tools that can be used. For example, we have in our medical schools a dispersed clinical education system. Students are out and about at different hospitals, maybe far away from the main campus, and we have identify tools that can be used so students can record and monitor the clinical experiences they have so you can compare across institutions, within an institution, across sites to see, does every student see a heart failure patient? Does every student see an acute abdomen? Does every student see other things that the students have identified as important? All these tools that don't have to come from the accrediting body are very, very useful for our purposes. So, for example, assessment of professionalism in the learning environment. This is a relatively new but very, very important focus. So LCME accreditation standards say that schools must define the professional attributes that students are expected to develop and to evaluate whether students have achieved those and to look at the environment to see if there are influences there that might prevent students from being altruistic, from having certain ethical standards. And the annual survey of medical schools from the AMA, for example, ask how and by whom students' professional behavior is assessed, which gets directly back to the standard requiring assessment of professionalism. And so we give them a lot of different options through OSCEs, by faculty, by patients, by other health professionals. And for example, we can also look at trends. For example, in the last year's survey, about 3/4 of medical schools used an OSCE as one of the means to assess student professional behavior. Incredibly increase over the last 10 years in the use of this particular kind of instrument. About 79 schools, little over half, use comments from other health professionals in the assessment of students' professionalism. Again, an increase. So you can look at trends, but you can also look at the process that schools use to achieve compliance with standards. An annual survey of graduating medical students asks respondents if they've been, and the term has disappeared, but it used to be mistreated. Have students been mistreated during medical school? You get the student's impression of this. Or have they observed other students being mistreated? So the ability to look within a school on this using this national instrument, but then across schools to see does a school rate higher or lower in terms of the percent of students that are being mistreated and the type of mistreatment allows the LCME to focus in on particular institutions to say, okay, you have a relatively high percentage of students who said they were mistreated. What are you doing about it? What kinds of steps are you taking? What kind of education is going on for your faculty and your students about this? So it allows you to hone in and look across institutions at particular cross-sectional and also trend data. The LCME also requires that students' clinical skills be observed. And that means that medical schools have to identify what the core clinical skills are and then has to use instruments to see if they are being evaluated. And we need to know what the results of that program evaluation about assessment of clinical skills is. So because things like assessment of clinical skills are not necessarily clear-cut, what a student interprets whether they're being evaluated for their clinical skills might be different whether the faculty think they're evaluating them. And so you need to use triangulation. You need to use multiple methods to get at the reality of what the situation is. And so, for example, the graduation questionnaire for graduating medical students asks, were you observed doing a history and physical exam in your surgery clerkship? During the full evaluation for an accreditation review, schools are asked to provide data themselves about whether there was assessment of clinical skills. And the students fill out an independent questionnaire that they develop themselves, which also provides data. So looking at these multiple sources, you get a feeling for what the truth is, if there is such a thing as truth in this kind of assessment, or at least what the consistent opinions are, and teams can then focus on the ability of, you know, is there consistency and this team can be happy, or is there inconsistency and the team has to drill down more deeply in terms of understanding what's going on related to that standard. And so having these multiple instruments, especially ones that are national and can be used across for comparisons across institutions, can be very, very valuable. Another example, when you look at not assessment of skills, but assessment of knowledge, is our National Board of Medical Examiners, which is the institution that develops the licensing exam for physicians, but it also develops subject tests within each of the clinical disciplines. So that there's a subject test for surgery, where students spend 12 weeks on surgery. At the end, most medical schools use the subject test in surgery, or in internal medicine, or in pediatrics. And so because so many schools use these instruments, there's ability to look again across medical schools to see how well is a school doing in comparison to its peers. And so data on performance, you know, and outcomes are collected. And again, teams can drill down across particular subject areas to see how well students are doing. And not maybe so much as an end in itself, but to see how schools are reacting to the results. If students aren't doing well on the surgery subject exam, what's the school doing about it? How is it using the data? How is it either feeding back into the clerkship or doing things that will allow students to do better? And how is that being managed at the central level for curriculum management? So we're able to get at not only outcomes, but process using these kinds of measures. Outcomes are important and we have to measure them, but figuring out why those outcomes happen is also important so that you can get into improvement and fixing problems that may have arisen in an institution. But we also use monitoring to see about new standards. You know, new standards have to be approved you know, by public hearing, we get a lot of feedback on some new standards, and we need to make sure that we're doing things that fit with what institutions, what the LCME thinks are important, but what institutions understand about their own programs. And so we look at the state of the art. And one of the standards that we're currently really looking at is the issue of interprofessional education and how we frame that into one or more accreditation standards. And so for the last several years, and you've got some of that data in your book, we've collected data on whether medical schools have required experiences with students from other health professionals. And over the years, the number of schools and the percent of schools has been steadily increasing, so that about 5 years ago, less than half of schools had such experiences, and now it's about three quarters. That kind of data provides support for a new accreditation standard. I mean, I think we would probably think it's important, and the LCME would do this anyway, but the ability to provide feedback to the schools that this is really something that is now in the national consciousness is important. And if you'd like to look at your data, shows that not only what experiences are happening, but with what groups and for what purposes. So we can get a feeling for what the utility of the interprofessional education experiences are, which will help us not only frame our standard, but frame the questions related to that standard. Okay, let me conclude by saying that regular monitoring collection of data is important. And it's important to do it from a variety of perspectives. And it's also very, very nice if the accrediting body doesn't have to develop the instruments themselves, that we have sponsors, and those sponsors have use for that data beyond accreditation, and they use it for other purposes. But they also communicate with the accrediting body to allow the framing of the questions in ways that relate directly to accreditation standards. And it's not only those kind of annual questionnaires that allow regular monitoring between accreditation within accreditation cycles, but it also allows the LCME, as it's working on, to ask schools for information about why within a cycle data change dramatically. And so we don't have to wait for 8 years to follow up on something that might be a problem. We have annual data, and we can act on it immediately. Data gathering also allows grounding and evidence for the need for new standards. And so whenever we contemplate a new standard, we try to collect some data about what the state of the art is. And the take-home message is accrediting bodies can do this by themselves, but it's also very, very useful to identify the kinds of instruments that are available, what are out there, and how to work collaboratively with the groups that are responsible for those instruments to allow the needs of accreditation to be included among the needs that are met by the instruments as well. So thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Our next presenter from nursing is Heidi Taylor.
I feel a little bit like the teacher I am now. On Thursday afternoons, after students have been in class all week long, two long days of clinical, they've had lunch, I have them at 1 o'clock. I'm going to ask you all to stand, raise your arms above your head, and shout, "Pharmacists rock!" Yay! There we go. There we go. Yeah. Nurses think pharmacists rock. You may not believe that, but we really do. Good afternoon. You just have to promise me I won't lose you. So that's just my gift to you to get you up and get your circulation moving again. I do want to say on behalf of the very few Texans that are in the room, let me say howdy, y'all, And I do bring warm greetings to you from Amarillo, Texas, the vacation capital of the world, and want to extend an invitation for you all to visit very soon. We think we've got a little slice of heaven there. And To do this in 10 minutes, I will not be able to pay close attention to my accent. If you have difficulty with my Texas accent, stop me afterwards and I'll do the interpretation for you a little bit better. I'm really very pleased to be here today representing the Commission on Collegiate Nursing Education. I am not an employee of CCNE, but I've done a fair amount of volunteer work for that organization in many different capacities, as well as to our parent organization, the American Association of Colleges of Nursing. Today, my comments are really shaped by my current service as the co-chair of the 2011-2012 Standards Committee, and we have been in a year-long process of review and revision of our accreditation standards. We hope we're nearing the end. As you might imagine, it's the standard related to program effectiveness that has given us the greatest grief. I appreciate this invitation to come to this meeting, and I really want to applaud you all for your efforts at getting this accreditation thing right, if that is indeed even possible when you are dealing with these complex issues surrounding learning, accountability, and frankly, in our worlds, patient safety, health, and healing. I was asked to address how CCNE evaluates our member programs' activities related to interprofessional education and those competencies in nursing. But first, for a few moments, let me just explain a little bit about CCNE. It is an autonomous accrediting agency that is recognized by the Department of Education to accredit baccalaureate and graduate programs in nursing, as well as our post-baccalaureate nurse residency programs. Many of you may know that nursing programs also reside in associate degree programs, as well as in hospital-based diploma programs. However, CCNE focuses only on baccalaureate and graduate education in nursing. Our parent organization is the American Association of Colleges of Nursing, but CCNE has its own board of commissioners who are separate and distinct from the AACN board. CCNE currently accredits more than 1,000 such programs in diverse institutional settings across the United States and in its territories. And it may be of interest for this group to note that the majority of the nursing programs we accredit do not reside in health sciences centers or academic health centers. They reside in general academic institutions, and this particular feature of our accredited programs has some relevance to the notion of interprofessional learning activities that I hoped to address today. I don't think I'll have time to do that, but just keep in mind that not all nursing programs have other health science programs with which to collaborate readily available to them, and this has spawned some very innovative and creative solutions to the notion of interprofessional collaboration. CCNE's standards of accreditation are specified in our standards document, and I put that in quotation marks, which was last approved in 2009 and is the version that is currently under review and revision by the committee that I co-chair at this time. These standards are publicly available on the CCNE website, and unlike our colleagues in medicine, we have four standards, each with key elements that further explicate those standards. Standard one relates to mission and governance. Standard two relates to resources, both human, fiscal, and physical. Standard three relates to the curriculum, and standard four does relate to program effectiveness. CCNE's expectations for high-quality nursing education programs have really been informed by many kinds of professional and interprofessional perspectives over the years. CCNE requires all programs to demonstrate that their mission, their goals, their expected outcomes, their curricula, and the program effectiveness are reflective of nursing's professional standards and guidelines. And although programs can choose from among many professional standards and guidelines that exist, they are required to, at a minimum, use the professional standards and guidelines for nursing education as have been published by the American Association of Colleges of Nursing's series of essentials documents. These essentials documents, which were developed through a broad process of review and revision, guided by task forces appointed by AACN, and then informed through a very wide participation of all of our constituencies and communities of interest, similar to what you're doing here, but across the country in numerous numerous forums, do set those generally accepted professional standards for nursing education at all levels. And these can be found in their entirety on the AACN website. But additionally, our broad constituency includes a diverse group of professionals and laypersons, really from many fields, to ensure that our expectations for curricula and high-quality programs are congruent, are current, and relevant as possible. And although I only include two groups' logos on this slide for the purposes of our discussion today on interprofessional education, you should know that we reach out to many, many different constituencies in the development of our professional standards, as are expressed in the AACN Essentials documents and in the shaping of the CCNE accreditation. So please do not assume that these are the only constituents that we've been listening to. For today's discussion, I'm going to focus on the issue of interprofessional education and the fact that that we have in the past and even in our current work of reviewing and revising our accreditation standards considered many different perspectives as we develop those expectations for IPE. In fact, I would comment that I know our colleague yesterday mentioned that nursing has been incorporating IPE since 2008, and I would suggest, in fact, it's been much earlier than that. 2008 was the date of our baccalaureate essentials document, but certainly prior to that, we've had other essentials documents that spoke to the importance of interprofessional education. And in fact, I would also say that this notion of interprofessional collaboration is certainly not new for nursing. I would argue that because of our very unique roles in patient experiences, we have always understood the importance of multiple professional perspectives and contributions to health and healing. The essentials documents reflect that commitment and that understanding. For baccalaureate graduates, Standard 6 of the essentials specifies the importance of interprofessional communication and collaboration for improving patient care outcomes and includes statements of abilities that are expected at the baccalaureate level. For example, they should be able to compare and contrast roles of various healthcare providers, to use interprofessional communication and collaboration to provide evidence-based care, to use effective communication, including negotiation and conflict resolution, and to demonstrate team building and collaborative strategies are among those competencies that are identified in this standard. And again, this is not an accreditation standard. It is the standard of the essentials documents. The essentials of master's education speak to interprofessional collaboration for improving patient and population health outcomes in their Standard 7 and specify some higher level expectations of graduates from master's programs moving toward leadership skills and roles, understanding other health professions' scope of practice and maximize the contributions within that healthcare team, to employ collaborative strategies in the design, coordination, and evaluation of patient-centered care, to use effective communication strategies to develop, participate, and lead interprofessional teams and partnerships, and to function as an effective group leader. And finally, the expectations for graduates of the practice doctorate or the Doctor of Nursing Practice, the DNP, are explicated in Standard 7 of the DNP Essentials with, again, a higher level of expected abilities for leadership, development of care models, and also for consultation in interprofessional teams. And, of course, you can read those specific statements there. As mentioned earlier, the CCNE accreditation standards require that programs utilize the essentials documents and the information in the essentials in developing, implementing, and evaluating their mission, their goals, and their expected outcomes. In Standard 1, in the curricula in Standard 3, and also in evaluating program effectiveness in Standard 4. Programs can also choose other professional standards that are more relevant or also relevant to their unique missions and their goals, or perhaps their unique context in the geographic area they serve. And I've included language from the CCNE standards that demonstrates that while we do not specify competence in our standards document, our standards of accreditation document, we do require that all of those things are reflective of the professional nursing standards and guidelines that are both required by CCNE, in this case the essentials, and a few others that don't particularly pertain to IPE, and also those that they choose that are more specific to their unique need. So in Standard 1, our key element 1B specifies that the mission goals and expected outcomes are reviewed periodically and revised as appropriate to reflect those standards. For curriculum and key element 3B, we expect individual student learning outcomes are consistent with the roles that the program is preparing its graduates, so forth and so on. And I think you can read those. Standard 4 is all about program effectiveness, and everything there must link back to those essentials documents. Our accreditation teams do evaluate using the notion of a preponderance of evidence. We are not just about hard data. We are also looking at qualitative data, and one of our values is that we do recognize the importance of quantitative and qualitative data. Once the team prepares the report, it is provided to the program for their review, and their response to that for omissions of any fact or for clarification. And it moves forward then to the Accreditation Review Committee, who then reviews all of that information and makes recommendations on further to the board for by utilizing the self-study document, the program's team's report, the program's response to the team's report, and the ARC recommendations. And, of course, these are the things that the Board of Commissioners evaluate to render an accreditation a decision. These are really managed. Other kinds of competencies for nurses are managed really no differently than IPE, because we do reflect back on those particular standards. And I'm sorry, I'm trying to be as rapid here as I can be. But let me just say that in the case of IPE, we really do not have a standardized measure for competence, but we do have expectations for programs to engage meaningfully in the work of interprofessional education through those essential standards and guidelines. And I do want to refer you to a recent article by one of your colleagues who happens to be in the audience, and I've just learned is one of my neighbors, and that is Dr. Joe Zorek and his colleague Cynthia Rail, who are from Amarillo, and we just now met today. They published a very nice content analysis of interprofessional education in the Journal of Interprofessional Care, I believe, just recently. And that one, in that analysis, I'm really pleased to see that CCNE, along with the ACPE, emerged as leaders in IPE-related statements. But like all of our professional programs that lead to licensure, nursing does have a standardized measure for basic nursing competence in the licensing examination, which for us is the NCLEX-RN. And here, I'm going to take my hat off as representing CCNE and speak from my own perspective, though I think this perspective is shared by many of my nursing colleagues, including those affiliated with CCNE. The NCLEX-RN is only one measure of basic nursing competence, and it is certainly not a complete measure. And I want to emphasize that while standardized assessments certainly have a place in our understanding of our students' knowledge, skills, and abilities, and determining the quality of educational programs, they also carry some risks in becoming barriers to creativity and innovative education, in my opinion. If competence is reduced to a set of checklists, we really will not capture the true essence of what it means to be a healthcare professional. CCNE has been very committed to the idea that no accreditation process or standard should be an obstacle to educational innovation and creativity. And it seems to me that the healthcare professions can really contribute in some pretty powerful ways to the dialogue about greater accountability in educational outcomes by helping educators and probably more importantly policymakers develop some comfort in qualitative and, dare I say, messy data that still reveals abilities and learning that is not very easily quantifiable. We are uniquely positioned to witness the mysteries and complexity of human health and healing, and we recognize that there are many times when a patient's outcomes cannot be explained by the science we have available to us. Learning is another another one of those complex human experiences that really cannot be completely or easily measured, tallied, and explained through statistical significance and experimental research. We really do need our best scholars to articulate this very complex and ambiguous reality, that all things that exist do not necessarily exist in some quantity that can be easily measured. In this, I think we have something to offer, and meetings like this one, I think, can really help us advance this discussion. Is it wise to keep seeking a set of standardized assessments for measuring student learning? If the answer is yes, then do we need them for everything? Is it prudent to develop assessments that allow comparisons of programs to one another, even though they may serve different constituencies? If the answer is yes, then how do we ensure that programs are accepting the same kinds of students? How do we ensure that diverse students have access to education if we only develop programs and expectations where only those students with a very successful and advantaged academic background can be good? We need to be working very hard on a nice balance between all of those things, things that are quantifiable and those things that are qualitative. And I thank you so much for your attention.
Our last speaker is Mary Jane Harris from Physical Therapy, and we'll pull up her slides. And again, we apologize for getting into your break time.
I'll see if I can be fast. We'll see. First of all, let me thank you for the opportunity to be here. Thinking about this as an interprofessional opportunity, so that in addition to hopefully helping you get some insights about physical therapy, I certainly have gotten some insights about pharmacy. And hopefully we can learn from each other and where possible, avoid the reinvention of wheels and learn from each other's mistakes, because we certainly have had some. I was asked to talk specifically about three things: how we assess clinical performance, where we are with interprofessional education, and a little bit about scholarship expectations. I spend most of my time talking about the clinical performance issues. By way of putting my comments into some context, let me make a few comments about CAPTI, just so you understand. CAPTI is a 31-member committee of APTA. Unlike CCNE or ACPE, we are still part of a parent organization, not separate, although we're working on it. We have been engaged, APTA has been engaged in quality assurance of PT programs since 1928 and PTA programs since 1969. Since 1990, our criteria related to curricular content have been based in student outcomes, statements of what we expect students to be able to do with their education, not what content needs to go into their education. And we leave it up to the programs to decide how best to put that information together in order to meet those expectations. let me go back. Because I'll get to that one. We currently accredit 211 PT programs and 293 PTA programs, and like pharmacy, we're in a growth mode with 22 developing programs, PT, and 65 developing PTA programs. We outdo medicine in numbers of criteria. We have almost 150 on each side, PT and PTA. PTs tending to be, as part of our professional persona, detail folk. Most of them are open to a significant amount of interpretation. One of them that is not, however, is the expectation for the amount of clinical education, which is what we refer to as internship activity. And we have specified a minimum of 30 weeks of full-time clinical education, which takes up about two semesters out of the average 7.6 semesters of a PT program that is built on top of a baccalaureate degree. So we're talking about 7 years of school, beginning to end. And ClinEd, therefore, takes up, in terms of length of time, about a third, a little bit more than a third. If you look at it at content, contact hours is about 44% of the student contact hours that are spent in full-time, on-the-job, supervised clinical experience. So what we've done in is to develop a document that is reflective of what has been determined by the profession to be our core curriculum, in the sense of what students need to know. And we have 99 statements of expectations about students and what students should be able to do, divided into three different categories of professional practice, patient-client management, and PT practice management. And this list here is essentially the categories, obviously, of the various expectations. In order to measure all of that, we've spent a fair amount of time of trying to figure out how we can do that. And I would tell you that this list of expectations came from a series of about five, I believe, consensus conferences in the late 90s, where we brought together probably about 100 in each one folk to do much like what you're trying to do, and that is to figure out what is the core of physical therapy education. And these statements came out of that effort, along with the effort of APTA to develop a description of the practice of physical therapy. So between those two things, we came up with all of this stuff that is stuffed into PT criteria. And then we set about trying to figure out how to measure it and developed the clinical performance instrument, which is and has been documented as being a valid and reliable instrument to measure student performance in clinical education. And I would tell you that the CPI, which we refer to it as, is only one of three documents or three tools that we use to measure the quality of clinical education. This one happens to look at student performance, but we also have a now a computerized document that collects information about all of our clinical education sites. And turns out we have more than 25,000 of them around the country, which is bigger than we thought. and we also have a document to use for students to evaluate the quality of the experience that they had. That includes not only their perceptions of that, but what they did during the time that they were there, so that that programs can gather that data and actually finally for the first time look at, did students get a breadth of experience across all the lifespan, the types of patients that PTs are most likely to see, the types of patient problems that that PTs are most likely to deal with, or did they find that most of their students went into orthopedics and didn't get the pediatrics and the geriatrics and some of the other acute care kinds of things. And those are the kinds of things that CAPTI would expect programs to look at. Like the materials that LCME uses, this is a document that was not developed by CAPTI. It was developed by APTA. And CAPTI does not require programs to use it, although 94% of our programs do, and I'm sorry, but the folks from Texas are the ones that don't. and the reason that they don't is because they developed their own, and at approximately the same time that APTA was doing theirs, and they've stuck by it. In the process of developing it, we took the group that did it took the 99 expectations and broke them down into broke them down into 18 smaller ones, and the tool itself has several parts, several components of it. One is a set of sample behaviors, and the expectation related to accountability, there would be a series of statements of what would, if you were seeing somebody who was accountable, what would you see? And there's a series of lists of things that then are listed there for the rater or the clinical instructor to look at to make that determination. In addition to that, 5 of these 18 criteria have been determined to be red flag items, which means if the student doesn't do well on those 5, they fail. They include things like safety, accountability, cultural competence, and I can't remember what the other 2 are, but they're critical pieces that are enough from a clinical perspective to say this isn't good enough. The expectation is that the student will be evaluated beginning at the midterm and at the end, and there's a space on the form for comments at that point. And then there's a rating scale that anchored anchored along the these basically the progression of expectations. So there's a place in for it for beginning performance, advanced intermediate, and entry level. And for the first time, we've gone and looked at whether or not we have students that are performing beyond entry level. And in some cases, we have. I forgot to mention that, but this is a good place to do it, that one of the things that's interesting about this tool was that when we were testing it, we found, and doing the pilot testing, we found that there were some students in some programs that were being graduated, that were being allowed to graduate before they had accepted, had demonstrated entry-level competence based on the use of this tool. And so one of the things that's positive about this is that for the first time we really have people with a definition of how to decide whether or not something is whether the performance is competent or not. And in order to do that, the 5 dimensions that we're looking at. 1 is supervision and guidance. How much time and effort is required by the supervisor in making sure that the student is doing what they need to do? What is the quality of what they do? How well do they do it? How complex are the patients that they're treating in this process? How consistent are they in the delivery of care, and how efficient are they? And I've given you essentially a look at what the anchors are and what the expectations are for the various anchors. So you can see in the required supervision that at the beginning it starts with they need 100% supervision and goes down at entry level to say they're capable of independence. Now the reason we use the word capable is that the clinical situation may not allow them to do that, to be totally independent, and that's true of the issue of efficiency. So, amount of supervision, what's the quality of what they do? How consistent are they with? How complex is it? And then how much of a caseload are they able to deal with? And only when they get to they're capable of independence, they're consistently proficient, and they're capable of 100% caseload would we consider them to be entry level in the delivery of PT services. We gather this information in 3 different levels. It's used certainly for the individual student assessment process, and schools determine whether or not successful completion is needed or whether they need to do remediation. CAPTI's on-site review teams look at the completed forms for process. We don't look at individual information, but they're used for that purpose. The school can aggregate the information and in order to determine its overall outcomes, and that information is provided to CAPTI in its review. And we will soon be able to, because the whole thing is now computerized, be able to aggregate national data. We're not able to do that quite yet, but fairly soon.